Greetings, this is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope. I am on the phone with Dr. Mark Giampapa, Deputy Director of the National Solar Observatory and an Adjunct Professor of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. Among his various research interests, Mark studies stars similar to the Sun to determine their activity cycles. His research is discussed in Robert Zimmerman's cover story, Finding the Sun's Lost Nursery, in the March 2012 issue of Sky and Telescope, and is also the subject of a sidebar in the cover story of our March 2009 issue. Dr. Giampapa, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob.
Great. Well, first, when astronomers talk about solar twins, what exactly do they mean? Obviously, we're talking about stars, you know, similar to the Sun in characteristics such as mass, luminosity, composition, and age. But what kind of characteristics does a star need to be considered a good solar twin?
Well, Bob, I think you just named all those characteristics. That is, they have to be very close in mass and chemical composition and effective temperature. Then there are some other parameters that are more relevant to certain aspects of stars that we studied, like activity. And then in that case, they have to have similar magnetic activity levels or rotation rates.
Right. And I know that you've spent a number of years researching solar-type stars and especially trying to determine their level of magnetic activity. That was the subject of our sidebar in the March 2009 issue. What have been some of the most interesting and important things that you and your colleagues have learned from these studies?
Well, some of the most interesting things is, in some ways, how similar the Sun can be to other Sun-like stars. For example, my studies in M67, at least 70% of the stars have magnetic activity levels, you know, sort of like spots and flares and chromospheric or coronal-like emission, very similar to the Sun. So in that sense, the Sun is not particularly exceptional. On the other hand, there are other Sun-like stars in that cluster that have levels that seem a lot more quiet than the Sun, that is, are much lower in their magnetic activity, and some that are higher. And so those are interesting because they could represent excursions in the Sun's level of activity over the millennia. And so that was my motivation for observing M67, was to gain more insight into the range of the Sun's activity levels.
And what's interesting, I mean, M67 is, you know, several thousand light years away, which means, you know, we're not exactly resolving star spots on the surface of, you know, the stellar population in that cluster, where with the Sun we have, you know, exceptionally detailed studies. How is it that you're able to measure the magnetic activity on these very distant stars?
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, they're just point sources up there, and that's the unique aspect of the Sun as a star. Besides giving us the energy that we need to live and sustain life on Earth, the Sun is an excellent laboratory to look at stellar processes. But on the other hand, it's just one star, and so by looking at other stars, we can look at a range of parameter space. And so with the stars, we have to be a little more clever and look at what we call radiative proxies, that is, like spectral lines or changes in photometric light curves that are due to things like spots or other magnetic regions on the star. And sometimes the strength of that emission and certain spectral lines indicates more widespread magnetic flux or magnetic fields on the surface of a star. So while we can't see the surface of the star, we can see evidence or tracers of this magnetic activity. The more clever we are at analyzing the spectrum of spatially unresolved stars, the more we can learn about what's on their surface, even though we can't see the surface.
Right, and one thing, you know, talking about the Sun for a moment, is, as many of our readers know, it recently experienced a relatively long solar minimum, but it seems to be returning to life the last year or so. But some solar physicists are predicting that the Sun might be headed for another prolonged minimum in the decades ahead, perhaps even something similar to the so-called Maunder minimum of several centuries ago. Looking at these analogs in M67, what's your thinking about those predictions?
Well, I think those predictions are not really outlandish. I mean, I think there's some real evidence for those predictions, or to support those predictions, from looking at the sun itself and then looking at other stars. Like I mentioned, about 10-15% of the stars in M67 had levels of activity that were pretty low, lower than solar minimum, although the last solar minimum, which was really quiet and it lasted a long time, was somewhat similar to these very low activity sun-like stars in M67. So maybe 10 or 15% of the time the sun might go into an extended period of quiescence, that is very low activity. And that's really of interest to us in a wide variety of other applications, like climate studies on the Earth, or space weather and its effects on the near-Earth environment and our space activities. So, yeah, it is true, the sun is coming back to life, but there are other indicators that it may be entering a long-term trend that could lead to very low activity. Mm-hmm. Although there are, of course, scientists who dispute that evidence, that say, well, no, this last minimum was not typical. It wasn't unique. That is, there's been previous minima that were long and had very, very large number of spotless days. But on the other hand, we don't have the same quantity and precision of data from those historically past minima that we have today.
Mm-hmm. Now, if, and I think I kind of have to ask you this question, although I realize it's opening a can of worms. If the sun were to enter a prolonged minimum, what effect might it have on Earth's climate and, in particular, human society?
Well, you are right, you know, that may open up a can of worms, but, you know, that's what science is all about, is to pursue different lines of evidence, have a lot of arguments, and eventually the truth emerges. And so, while it may be controversial, that doesn't mean we don't engage in the discussion. And so, what it may mean for the Earth if it goes into a prolonged period of quiescence is a little unclear. Again, we have to look at history and what we think we learned from it. And in the Northern Hemisphere, at least in European records, the Maunder Minimum Sun, the sun that corresponded to what we call the Little Ice Age, was correlated with very cold temperatures in Europe, very unusually bitter winters. Seemingly in the Northern Hemisphere. But my understanding of some of the other geological or historical data is that it also led to excursions in temperatures that could be much warmer than usual, too, at other points on the Earth. So I think, as I understand it, the lesson we have from past studies of both the historical record of observation and then the geological record of other evidence means that it's just going to cause a lot of departures from the average locally, and that could mean higher temperatures or lower temperatures. But, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future results. As usual, we can make a lot of models and predictions, but nature always has a way of doing its own thing, despite what we think we know about it.
One thing that I think would be, quote, good about a prolonged minimum is, and tell me if this is unreasonable speculation, is it would make human spaceflight into really deep space easier if the sun is not putting out as many, you know, flares and coronal mass ejections. There might be a window that would make it easier for astronauts to fly to Mars and maybe beyond, or asteroids, and avoid, you know, more intense radiation exposure. Is that reasonable or unreasonable speculation?
Well, you know, first, your first point is very important about the radiation exposure in long-term space flights, and that's really a limiting factor for human space flights to Mars and beyond. Now, will the quiet sun mitigate the effect of radiation? Well, there's still the ever-present cosmic ray radiation, galactic cosmic rays, extragalactic cosmic rays, and they still pose a danger to astronauts. Well, what about flares from the sun and coronal mass ejections? Well, you are right. There would be fewer. However, when they do occur, I mean, past observations of the quiet sun show that some of the most explosive coronal mass ejections and flares occur during the relatively quiet times on the sun, even though we don't have very frequent flare occurrence. We do sometimes have occasional large outbursts, and so I would not bet on the safety of a long spaceflight with human astronauts during the quiet sun. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's not as safe as we might think, and it's somewhat of a myth to think that the sun does not have, you know, powerful coronal mass ejections or other outbursts during solar minimum. It's just that they're not as frequent.
Right, that's a very good point.